This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Giddy hit Austin! My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
I'm gonna find that girl. She was last seen walking around Sunset. Said that she was trying to get home. I tried to pick her up last week. She said she'd rather be alone. She never wanted me to turn around and see the things that she had done before. I'm gonna find that girl. I'm gonna find that girl. Like we're racing, both of us are always on the go. Some matters require
fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you weekly live from Trinidad World Recording Studios in Fort Worth, Texas. My recording studio here in Fort Worth. With me is my good friend, confidant, and singer-songwriter, Kurt South. How you doing, Kurt?
I am awesome today. How are you, Phil?
Doing quite well, thanks.
Good.
We've got a great show here today. We've now been on the air, I don't know, 10, 12
we've done a
episodes.
Lot. We're radio veterans at this point.
We're being broadcast worldwide online, philpritchett.com. Also, our good friends at Radio Free Texas carrying us out there. More following. Thank you, everybody, for listening, for sending us your comments. That's going to come up in our middle section. We're going to delve into the mailbag.
Yeah.
We've been getting a lot of
ever
emails.
Growing mailbag.
Ever growing. We're going to have to get a mail room here at Trinidad.
My inbox
just
is just filled up.
You know, I haven't received a letter, though. No letters. All email.
All emails.
No analog mail has been received. I think that's a sign of the times.
It is.
I shouldn't be looking for it when the post office guy shows up. That's just not how you get your mail,
folks.
Mailman
just knocks on the door and just empties a bag on the front porch of Trinidad.
Boy, I'd love it. Like the old days, Johnny Cash, you know, where he just gets mail from prisons. Yeah. Not to be here. We just get postings and little things on our MySpace.
And by the way, I would like to implore to anyone incarcerated out there, please let us hear from you. We want the prisoner.
You do.
We want to hear from the prisoner.
You, the prisoner, wherever you may be, if you're a music fan. Well, you know, whoever you are, if you make music, if you listen to music, if you're like Kurt and I, you do both a creator, a producer, songwriter, but good grief, all of us are big fans, and that's kind of what this is about. Talking Texas music, playing your own music, how to get it out there, what works, what doesn't. So we're going to look at some of our comments in the mailbag in our middle section. First section here, let's devote a section to some of the best gear we've ever stumbled across.
Yes.
We'll talk about the best guitars we've ever played in our first segment, followed by the middle segment with the mailbag, and then in the vault, we're going to take a little different spin here. We usually cover a Pritchett record or something I'm working on. We talked about some of your recordings, Kurt, before. And then most of our vault selections have been from about 1971 to about 1973.
Yeah.
So far. You had some Rod Stewart, Van Morrison, Elton John. Jumping up to, what do you have there, 1984?
1983.
A&M Landmark, Records. The final record from one of the greatest bands of all time until they made a reunion tour.
Yes.
They're still pretty great. I love them. The Police, of course, we're talking about Synchronicity in the Vault. That was Kurt's pick. Pulled it right out of the batch.
Yeah.
Very excited about that.
It was a landmark album for my adolescent years.
Man. We'll get into that. That's What's On Phil's iPod in the final segment. You know, this first segment, it was going to be part of our mailbag discussion, but I think it warrants its own segment here. A couple of guys have emailed me, and a couple of ladies about the kind of gear. I got an email from a gal buying some gear for her husband a while back. She wanted to know what kind of pedals I used for the electric guitar. Of course, she was sorely disappointed.
When you said, I have a tuner.
I said, I have a tuner. That's about it. I do play with very, very little gear, very few pedals. In fact, no pedals. I have a Boss blues driver.
Yeah.
You know, just a little drive, a little stomp. The rest of the time, I'm just rolling the dials. But I had a couple of comments of guys saying, you know, what's your favorite guitar? Or more interestingly, what's the best guitar you've ever played? Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have been in a lot of studios and bars and around a lot of music stores, other musicians all over the world, you know, and you're always, music's one of those things that's everywhere. You're always picking up stuff
right,
in a store or, hey man, you mind if I play your guitar? So it got me to thinking, what are some of the greatest instruments I've probably ever picked up or ever played on? You want to go first?
Yeah, sure.
Kurt South, go first.
Since my primary instrument is the acoustic guitar, I will start with the great acoustic guitar
Indeed.
Or guitars that I've played.
Indeed.
One that jumps to mind, I stumbled across in the great Groon Guitars, which is a legendary high-end guitar
Broadway.
Seller. Broadway in Nashville, Tennessee.
It was on the Visa commercial years ago.
Right.
Groon Guitars, bring your Visa card.
You can walk into Groon Guitars on any given day, and Vince Gill is buying something, or Travis Tritt, or Sammy Kershaw is drunk upstairs. Want something like that. There's always someone famous in there.
It's right across the street. Is the Ryman right up the hill there?
Yes, it is.
Is it behind it or kind of?
It's kind of catty corner,
I guess.
It's
not far from there. It's
right
on the
hill there.
Groon is on the corner of Broadway, one of those little side streets.
Yes. But it's where the who's who in Nashville go to buy a $10,000 acoustic guitar. That's
no
what you're in the market
about
for.
It. No question.
And I remember I was in there one day trying not to touch guitars because they don't like it when you do that there for the most part.
And
I struck up a conversation with the guy who was working in there, and I was just happened to be in front of some vintage Gibsons, and there was a J45 that I believe was from the mid to late 70s hanging on the wall, and he was talking about that guitar in particular, pointing out that this guitar is cream of the crop,
really, really,
and like, yeah, man, looks great, looks cool, and you know, it was a five-figure guitar. It was a very expensive guitar.
Yeah, right.
And he said, man, you want to try it out? You can see what I'm talking about. I'm like, sure. I only had like four beers in me. So I said, sure. I would love to.
You and Kershaw.
I had been drinking at the Tin Roof that afternoon.
It was probably Kershaw's old guitar that he hawked.
Yeah. So he lets me play this guitar. And it's rare that I am blown away by an instrument. It's very, very rare. Especially high-end instruments. Usually I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
This one, if I'd had the money in my pocket, I would have paid it right then.
It is one of those things where if it's really expensive, you expect a whole lot.
And you're usually really cheap, let down.
Yeah, and if it's really cheap, you don't expect much. So
yeah.
The surprise lies within, you know.
Yes.
Being surprised with a cheap one or disappointed with an expensive one.
Exactly. And this guitar was just, I still remember how it felt, how it sounded. You know, I remember what I played when I picked it up. Yeah. I mean, it left an impression on me. It was just that great.
The J45.
And the other guitar that I consistently say is just the best thing I've played is the one I own right now, the Guild D50.
Is that right? Yeah.
That guitar is the best purchase I've ever made. And other people who play it, they pick it up and go, man, this guitar is incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not that expensive a guitar. You can get one for around $1,000. Which in the world of acoustic guitars is pretty.
It is. Yeah, you played
it's not
on
that
last, on your last record in here. It's a very good sounding guitar.
But yeah, I mean, guys consistently pick it up and are just blown away. And I got lucky with that one. You know, I just happened to buy one that came out of the factory, just incredible.
I find the acoustic guitars are very less than the electrics. I always felt like with an electric, if the neck was straight, and
the pickups were decent.
Well, you know, but you can change all that stuff.
Right.
The acoustic is very difficult. And I found with the older, of course, the older they are, the cooler they look. A lot of times, the better they sound.
Mm-hmm.
They just sound, they have a drier, woodier tone.
The wood ages, yeah.
Yeah, and it just, you know, people talk about a guitar coming into its own, you know, the older it gets. But you do run into with the acoustics, especially on those old acoustics, you do with warping and some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The necks can be crooked. I feel like you really have to look carefully.
Yes,
you know, maybe hold that guitar up, put your chin down there by the bridge and stare down that neckline. And you can see if those frets are lined up pretty straight.
Right.
Or if there's a little wave in the board. And or if the action is really high when you get up the neck, you know, maybe around
right.
the 12th fret, you're, you know, 2 inches off the.
Right.
Because I've done that, because you do see the old Gibson and the necks. The other thing you got to look for on the old guitar is if the headstock's been broken off.
Right.
With, like on my Telecaster, but they can be repaired.
Yeah.
And knock some of the price off for you.
Yeah.
For me, I was playing. I went to a session in Nashville for my friend Wes Cunningham,
mm-hmm.
and he had this guy producing it. God's last name was Barlow. I can't remember his first name, but he is an uber producer guy. I mean, he's had like 100 guitars in the rolling away cases, you know?
Yeah.
And he had a Gibson Blue Ridge. Have you seen one of these?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, not really one of the more expensive ones. I don't think, I don't know a whole lot about him. It just says Blue Ridge right there on the
mm-hmm.
headstock. And he said, a friend of his who had died had given it to him. His wife, widow, had given it to him, said he'd want it to be on records, you know. And
mm-hmm.
he just said, man, that's the greatest guitar I've ever recorded.
Yeah.
And I didn't know a whole lot about it. I mean, I was always over there banging on all those guitars. And, man, yeah, same experience you had. You pick it up. So much of it has to do, if it's already in tune, when you hit that first chord and you just get that little rush of magic.
Right.
It's hard to pick up even the greatest guitar if it's not in tune and the strings are kind of new and not really stretched out. It's hard to get that rush. You kind
right.
of stick with it. So maybe that's sort of some luck of the draw. But that Blue Ridge really stood out to me.
Yeah.
The other one for me, you own one of the greatest guitars you've ever played, of course, is my 51 necked Fender Telecaster. It's a Frankenstein Tele. It's over here. It was hanging on the wall in South Austin Music.
Yeah.
About, 1998. Saw it in there. It's just the classic, you know, Springsteen, Keith Richards, butterscotch style, maple neck. All the finish is rubbed off the neck. It belonged to a guy named Lonnie Atkinson, who was a great country player in Austin. And it had the smeared signature of George Jones on it, very clearly when I bought it. Up on the, above the front pickup, just scribble on a Sharpie. That's since, it's still, you can still kind of see it on there, but it's since just been worn away.
Thus the name Little George. That
Little,
you
it was, well, it's like, you know, Seinfeld was around then. You had, Kramer had that chicken. You had Little Jerry Seinfeld in the cockfights. Remember that?
It's Little Jerry.
Little Jerry Seinfeld. So that was Little George Jones. Little George Jones was the Telecaster. And, man, it has never let me down. Of course, it played great. It started having some neck problems, though, a distinct back bend developing over the years, sadly. And then one night we opened for Robert Earl Keen at Flores Country Store, and in a fit of enthusiasm, I took it off and I threw it across the stage, as I had many times, but it landed on the top and snapped the headstock off. It has since been repaired. So it's seen some miles, but that's definitely one of the greatest electrics I've ever played. I've played a million guitars. J.W. Marshall's father, J.C.,
mm-hmm. The great J.C.
in Effingham, Illinois, has an original 1965 Ludwig drum kit, Black Oyster Pearl, in his basement. And, man, you want to talk about great-sounding drums. I mean, ridiculous. When you're used to recording the kind of the punk-ass, pawn shop kits and stuff riding around in the van that we have.
Yeah.
It's just been down there, and he's like, it's an original 66. I'm like, where'd you get it? He's like, I bought it new in 66. I mean, he's just had it the whole time. Definitely the best drum kit I've ever banged around on. And Stu really freaks out. He goes down there and plays those drums every time they go.
Sweats all over him.
Sweats all over him, that's right. But JC, all the good people there in Illinois, got some great gear. He's also got like a late 50s. Gibson Hummingbird.
Really?
Which is right up there with that Blue Ridge for me. I mean,
an
incredible sounding guitar. Mint condition, but worn in. So, man, what other kind of gear? What other kind of gear have you stumbled across?
Man, I don't know what year it was, but a Gibson Gold Top.
Yeah.
Les Paul. That was
Well, you know, Zach Huckabee brought in a early 70s Les Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just playing it clean, man. I mean, into an amp, and it just has the most amazing clean tone.
The greatest sound. And this guitar, just the feel of the neck and just, yeah, that you, it was just going right into like a Fender Blues Junior. Just, man, that's the sound that if you play electric guitar that you're always,
trying to get.
And, you know, that's one that really jumps out. But, you know, I've played one guitar in particular that I played that I remember being really fantastic was another acoustic in Nashville. Mm-hmm. It was in a studio on Music Row, owned by a guy I know named Billy Herzig, who was a producer up there
produced,
for a long time.
Yeah, Jordan McCoskey.
Yeah, and he now lives in Texas. But his house guitar in his studio on Music Row was a late 70s Alvarez.
Yeah. Huh.
And it was not a real high-end Alvarez model. It was just kind of a middle-of-the-road. I believe it was a mahogany top. I remember it was a real dark, dark-colored wood all over it. And we were in there doing some demos or messing around on Jordan's album, something. And I picked that guitar up and started playing it. And I remember he just looked at me and smiled, and he goes, "It's badass, isn't it?" And I was like, yeah it is. What I mean, because, man, just
it just
it
comes
forever.
Together a certain way.
It just... Yeah, he said it's just one of those that got better as it aged, and he goes, you know, I've got rooms full of guitars. I can use any guitar I want. I can walk down the street to that studio and borrow a 1952 Martin D28 if I wanted to. But that one right there.
You know, when I'm recording bands in the studio, we've got several drum kits I like to use. Everything from a kind of a clean, you know, loud DW we got in there, and some of Coatney's. His old Jack Ingram kit here in the studio, the Blue Sparkle kit. That's what everybody wants to play when they're
in here.
That's
a great kit.
Is that Pete Coatney's old drum kit? I'm like, sure is. So the drums, you know, they've all got their own different character. The guitars, you know, if you plug into my Silverface Super Reverb in here, my old Music Man, I can get the tone. You can be playing a whatever, you know.
It doesn't matter.
I can get the tone.
Right.
Mic and stuff. Man, if a guy sits down here with an acoustic guitar...
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you're getting.
No,
that is by far and away, in my engineering producing experience, just you don't know what it's going to sound like. I mean, you can use, you know, hey, I use this old AKG mic on my, you know, my Guild, and it just sounds great. And you mic up some other dude's guitar the same way, and it's all low end.
Right.
There's no, you can't believe it. It's astounding how different the acoustic guitars sound, and it's astounding how... really how not good most of them sound.
Yeah, that's very true.
It's rare that one sounds really great.
Even an expensive one.
Oh, I've had guys come in here with thousands of dollars worth of you know...
a $2,000 Taylor.
Yeah, and they just kind of don't sound great.
Here's an interesting...
I'm kind of like, man, I've got it, because I got a couple here that I like.
Mm-hmm.
My old Takamine, which with the hole in it, is it's just... kind of that kind of this. It's
awesome,
just kind of worn in. It sounds really, I know how to mic it. It's just, man, you do this on that.
Yeah.
It sounds good. A lot of variation in the acoustic guitar. And I wonder about like the guitars you talk about, or the Hummingbird in J-Dub's basement. If you mic'd it up, if it would sound good. I mean, you'd think it would, but you really don't know.
Well, the thing with the acoustic guitars, here's an interesting point that Mikey Wynn explained to me. Mikey Wynn,
who's a luthier.
Yeah, he went to luthier
school maker,
several years ago, now makes his own guitars. He says that if you take 100 guitars, whether it be a basement model Epiphone, $150 acoustic guitar, or you take 100 guitars and they're all $3,500 Taylors,
mm-hmm.
he said out of those 100, there's going to be 25 that are great, that are just awesome.
That really
doesn't matter what price range you're in.
Right.
25 would be great. The next 25 will be pretty good.
Right.
There'll be the next 25 will be so-so, and then the last 25 will suck.
Yeah.
And see, I've picked up a $10,000 guitar and played it and just said, this sounds like crap.
Yeah.
It's a piece of crap.
I have too. It's
but
always
shocking. When you're dealing with acoustic guitars, the sound comes from the wood top.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dealing with wood, you're dealing with, it's not a manufactured product. It's natural. It's, you know, every tree's different.
That's right.
So there's all these variables that go into it, and it might be a certain grade of spruce or cedar or something that they chose. And, man, we use the best woods. But
it's all kind of different. That's right.
It's all relative. So some of my favorite guitars have been, you know, I don't buy real expensive guitars because I'm going to tear them up and beat them up on the road
anyway.
Plus,
you can't afford it.
And I can't afford it. But man, I've had such good luck with, you know, with some guitars that were just middle of the road, anybody could go pick one up and buy it.
Well, it's amazing, though, how many guys, everyone thinks their guitar sounds great. A lot of, no one thinks they can sing, but everybody thinks their acoustic guitar is awesome.
Is the best. Yeah.
I'm like, man, you can sing great. Your guitar sounds terrible.
Yeah.
A big mistake, I think, and this is, people will find issue with this, is I don't recommend people restring a guitar before coming to record.
Absolutely.
Now, maybe on an electric, I think that can help once you stretch them in. But on acoustic guitars, man,
bring in the dead string.
Not only are there tuning issues throughout the session until they get really worn in, you just get a. I guess if you got a really dark sounding guitar, some new strings would help it a little bit. But 9 times out of 10, you get that brittle,
brassy overtones that you can't EQ. You can't do anything
with them out, man. some guys come in here with just a lot of kind of some rusty worn in strings and start banging on a guitar. And you get that mic set out in front of it, and you don't even EQ it. You just get a nice thick sound out of it. You're always going to get kind of the high end. I mean, just from
the nature high strings of the instrument.
And the pick. It is. What you lack a lot of times is kind of the body and the warmth.
Right.
It depends on the guitar. But guys come in here with, a not very expensive guitar with brand new strings on it, and it can be problematic from the start of the session.
Back in the late 60s, early 70s, I've read that a lot of these old, kind of the folk singers who were always trying to go for a more organic, earthy tone.
Right.
They would, if they had new strings on their guitar and they were going into the studio, they would take a brush and brush barbecue sauce or ketchup or something like that onto their strings.
Is that right?
To deaden them and get a certain sound out of them.
Yeah.
And in a lot of circles, that kind of dead string acoustic guitar tone is what people are going for.
Yeah.
And when I started recording myself at home, that was one of the first things I learned, was take the new strings off, have the dead strings on there, because on the recording, it's going to come alive.
Absolutely.
It's sound good.
Well, there's some instrument talk. Answer some questions. What's your favorite guitar, Phil, Kurt, that you've ever played? We hope we answered some of that just now. Coming up, we're going to delve even deeper into the ever-expanding Phil Pritchett podcast, P2 Podcast Mailbag. Stay tuned. Things you gotta take slow. Yeah, I'll try to be what you see in me, more than I just choose to show. I'm gonna find that girl. I'm gonna find that girl. Hey! This might take the better part of this segment, but I think that's okay, because a lot of our listeners out there, Kurt, are guys starting a band. Maybe they're in a full-time, band. Maybe they're just kind of doing hobby recordings, got a MySpace page. Or, God bless you all, you're just music fans and you like to know how stuff gets made and some perspective on things. But Greg was talking about, it sounds like he's got a friend of his who's got some recording gear up in Spokane. But he's also talking about how his uncle has some contacts with some Nashville folks and stuff like that. It sounds like he's a country guy. He didn't say in his email, but about recording, spending some serious cash.
Oh, yeah.
But he's got a backer, Sal. He's got a backer.
He's got investors.
He's got a guy who's going to come up with 30 grand and do it right the first time. So Greg was like, should I? It's my first album. I'm still kind of working through stuff. Should I go big while I got the chance? Or should I just do some stuff with my friend and play some gigs around here? Which is an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Very
because interesting. It's exactly what I deal with here in my own studio, Trinidad, recording guys. Many, many ways to go here. Of course, when bands could sell tonnage, even in Texas music, late 90s, you could maybe sell several thousand sometimes of a popular CD. And you have those checks rolling in every month selling CDs. So you could justify spending tens of thousands of dollars maybe on a record.
Right.
And I've done that. Not too much, but a few times. But
yeah.
That was kind of the par for the course. Hey, man, to do something that even sounds remotely decent, you got to go up and spend this. Of course, the advances in home recording have come along. Recording's gotten cheaper. People have GarageBand, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
There are some quality issues there, of course. You know, they're not going to be as good as going to record through your Neve console to 2-inch tape down at wherever. But there's no question that for a few thousand dollars in computer equipment and software, you can make some viable recordings. There's no doubt. So what would you say to Greg in Spokane? He's got his buddy, maybe has that kind of a home rig. Or does he go big, man, and do it right the first time? I think I know what your answer is, Kurt, but I want to hear you tell our listeners what the answer is. What do you think?
I've gone big.
Yeah.
So I'm speaking from experience. I've gone big. I've gone small. Man, if you're just starting out and you're just looking to kind of build a local regional fan base, get your songs out there.
As anyone's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the point. In this day and age of commerce and music where they collide, if you go spend that $30,000 or $40,000 to do it right, quote unquote, the first time, you're not going to make that back.
No. You're just not.
I would say look at the whole thing as a learning and growing process.
Right.
Start out with what you can handle. Focus more on coming up with good material than a good recording, because a good recording of a bad song is still going to suck. So
as we've learned, so
as
many
we
times.
Have learned, so I would just go and do what you can do with your friend that is don't
competent,
go into debt.
Interested, helpful, sounds like
right. Go into debt. That's a bad place to start off.
Man, there's no
question.
It is
a bad place to start off.
And this is something I try to really pound into the guys and the singers and people who come into my studio. We've got a great facility here. But because I am engineer, owner, and producer and all that and can, you know, bang out some keyboard parts for you, drums, whatever, there's a lot of vertical integration, so to speak.
Right. Which is why you're here.
Which is why I'm here. I've evolved to this point, South. But the point is, what I'm trying to do is have a place that can give you a professional product without mm-hmm. having to spend that kind of money.
Right.
And I think we've done that and shown
absolutely.
that is absolutely possible. Man, anybody trying to spend that kind of money, I would just always advise against in today's age.
Mm-hmm.
You have to set up your budget for your record, for your recording, to where, if it gets downloaded for free off MySpace, if it's exchanged tons of times on BitTorrent sites throughout the world, that has to be good news for you.
Right.
Give your record away. There's just no money in selling recorded music. Especially for someone starting out.
Right.
Now, someone like the Beatles, or even like yourself, or myself, who does have like a catalog.
Right.
We can bundle things together in all sorts of fun little bunches. Hey, man, you know, this record is cheaper. You get this on the website. You can get this on iTunes and single downloads. You know, we do have that income.
Mm-hmm.
Man, if you're just starting out, I would suggest spending no more than maybe, you know, $5,000
mm-hmm.
recording. And just give it away.
Right.
Let people hear it. Don't make it for $5,000 and then, you know, not, and then say, hey man, it's $12. I got to make my money back.
Right. Right.
It's just never going to happen.
It is.
You're not even going to make the $5,000 back, probably. But what you hope happens is for that investment, it spreads like wildfire, man. We got people signing up on our Facebook and all this kind of thing, and I have a disc that I send to clubs and bars and festivals and people's mm-hmm. weddings, and you know, you hear people driving down the street, you know, playing your music in their car.
Right.
You want to get your music in as many iPods and on as many hard drives as possible.
Absolutely.
That is the game. And if you bring pricing into it from the outset, you're putting a wall up between you and your future fans.
Yeah, there's no question. Basically, let me put it this way. If I were starting over right now, this day in 2009, year of our Lord,
indeed.
And I was in that position, I would work up two songs that the best I can offer. Really good songs.
Yeah.
Record them both, release one, and then next month release the other.
Yeah.
And hopefully in the next couple months you'll come up with another one or two really good songs. But really focus on making those songs great. Work on the arrangement. Go over your lyrics. Make sure it's got the good melody. Make mm-hmm. sure it's just a good song.
You've got to go to a good producer as well.
Yeah, yeah. And you've got to have somebody who can pull that out of you.
Yeah.
And focus on finding the guy who has the experience and can give you the advice to make your songs great. And then test the waters. Because here's the good news. If you put out one song and no one likes it, no big deal.
You haven't lost anything unless you've spent 10 grand.
If
you
put out
10 grand.
If you put out a whole album and it sucks, well, you're pretty behind in the game. I mean, that's what I would do if I were starting over today because, you know, you're not going to live and die by that one single.
Right.
If it doesn't go over well, there's going to be another one next month. And let's see how that goes. But you're always keeping yourself above water. You're never putting yourself back so far that you have to get something back for it. And that's where the freedom comes.
That's right.
Right there.
And the thing I tell people who come in here, there's just a huge difference between the lifer, someone who, they fall in one of two categories. Everyone wants to play music for a living and be successful.
Mm-hmm.
We're all starting with that dream. Everybody knows what the dream is, right? But there's a lot of fantasy out there as well.
The dream can quickly become a nightmare.
Yes, indeed it can. And the way to avoid that is to spend as little money as humanly possible.
Right.
Now, the next thing all these guys are going to tell me is, yeah, but look at this guy, man. Hey, and what I tell them is, hey, someone always wins. Every time a lottery ball is drawn, somebody wins.
Right.
And we all know his name. Every time the roulette wheel spins in a Vegas casino, you know, somebody wins.
You always remember the name of the one
somebody
guy who
wins,
but you don't ever know the other 30
the
people
masses,
who lost their ass.
And it doesn't matter that they lose, only how much they bet. Did he
exactly.
bet? Well, he bet $10,000. You know, that guy's screwed. Well, if he has $1 million, he's okay. If that was all of his money, then that was not a smart thing to do.
Right.
It depends. You have to have a handle on your situation. And, you know, I had one guy that was real sheepish about putting a little bit of money. He was making a record, not with me, but he was like, gosh, I don't want to put $1,000 on a credit card to pay for a record, which is a good thought.
Yeah.
So he was going to go borrow it, though, from a good friend of his. And I kind of said, now, you might want to think about that. And he said, what do you mean? He goes, it's never good to put it on a credit card. Of course, I've done both. But
right.
I'd say, look, you can pay off the credit card. And, you know, and I think a better way to do it is to go to a small bank, get a small loan where you have a monthly payment. Do like an 18-month note, something like that. That'd be my recommendation to finance a record. You know, but man, going to families and friends, that seems easy and they're supportive and everything. But let me tell you what, man.
Never
works
you know
this, out. Well, you're not going to make the money and you're not going to pay them back.
No.
I mean, 99 times out of 100, you're just not going to be able to do it. And man, you're going to have Thanksgiving dinner with Uncle Joe. You know, or dad, for the rest of your life. How's that music coming? Yeah, sold any CDs lately? And you're like, oh, yeah. And man, it is a very, very, very tough spot to be in.
I try to
paint a clear picture that, there's credit cards and you don't want to borrow money from the bank. But hey, the bank, you give them $200 a month for a year and, you're walking. So, a lot of ways to do it. There is no reason to go spend that kind of money unless someone else is going to pay for it, unless it's you got to deal with Warner Brothers or something.
Right.
But those deals aren't out there
anymore.
Those
deals aren't out. Well, what I tell people is at some point if you're going to try to generate some sort of living off of it, then you by default become a small business owner.
Oh, there's no question.
And if you aren't thinking in that direction from the get-go, if you're really wanting to pursue it, you're going to be in trouble. And I wish I had thought that way 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It would have changed a lot of things. But, you know, the way I look at it now is if I'm going to go record a song, buy a new instrument, do anything, I don't do it unless I have that cash in my pocket.
Man, that's just words to live by there.
That's it.
I apply people to do, you know, I got some old cars I drive around, but, I pay cash for those cars. Everyone's like, man, I got a great deal on this car. You pull up in a new car that they paid $35,000 for and it's taking $600 a month out of your check. I'm just like, man. And, man, you cannot make records like that.
No.
Especially today.
No. Nope.
You are dead meat, Greg in Spokane. I hope I caught you in time. Don't spend any money, man. Learn something. Buy your own Tascam recorder. Hell, I did High Tide in the Heartland in the Stockyards on an $800 24-track Tascam recorder.
I did River City Blues on that
You
same
recorded
Tascam
the record
recorder.
On that. It just, you know, it's a few microphones and some, reading stuff on the internet to kind of learn how to do it and having some... Most of producing is just comparative listen. Listen to the records you think sound great.
Yes.
Listen to that Ryan Adams record or something, or that Beatles album you think that sounds so cool. And man, you'll get, and then listen to your stuff, just A-B it back and forth. You'll see real quick, man, whether your guitar is just crazy bright and compressed.
Right.
Oh man, it sounds terrible. Their acoustics barely in the mix. Or man, the snare's just got a real warm, just kind of thump to it, man. Mine's got this piccolo high-end crack, this ring.
Right.
Maybe throw a towel over it. Man, it's amazing what you can do just by paying attention and listening.
And I'll tell you this, Greg. My two most financially successful releases have been the two I spent the least amount of money on.
There's no doubt.
One of them being the one that I did on your Tascam.
Yeah.
So
from download one, you were in the black.
I was in
just about
the black. So
you know, and there's a big difference. Don't come in here to the studio telling me you want to play music for a living. Because if you want to play music for a living, then play music for a living.
Go do it. Gigs
get
everywhere.
In the car, there's gigs everywhere. You got a car, don't you? You got a guitar, don't you? Then go play. What are you coming to me for? They're like, well, of course, what they really want to do is, I only want to play music for a living if I have a bus and an in-ear monitor rig and a lot of money and huge record sales and can use this producer.
Yeah.
Then
I want to
play music for a living, you know. But, you know, the guys in Austin, like the Gords and Bob Schneider and James McMurtry, they still pull up at the Granada in a van with a U-Haul.
Mm-hmm.
Very little merch. They have like one T-shirt to sell. Man, those guys have paid their dues, man. Those guys are 40-something years old, all of them. McMurtry, maybe 50. How old is he?
Yeah, he's close to 50, yeah.
These guys have paid their dues, man, and they're not going to spend that money they're making on, you know, ordering T-shirts and having a bus and all that kind of stuff. Now, that's not putting guys down who travel like that. I'm not. But, man, there's no question they're leaving money on the table by traveling like that. So that's the fantasy. You know, there are guys out there doing it. Everybody knows who the winner is. Everyone knows who won the lottery. But, Greg, you got to get in the game, man. Let your friend make your record. Listen to the records you like and learn something, man, that'll carry you far. Well, that's the mailbag talking about recording, budgeting, a little producer talk we got into there, Kurt.
We did.
Coming up, we're going to get into one of the great records I have at Trinidad World Recording here. Over on the wall, out of the vinyl vault, pulled out the old vinyl copy just to get just to wrap our hands around and get a sense of this record. 1983, the swan song of the great band The Police. Synchronicity in the vault when we come back. Welcome back, everybody. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth. With me is my good friend and fellow singer-songwriter, Kurt South. Hello, Kurt.
Ready to talk some Police.
Oh, man. Well, you know, we were joking earlier about, we've talked about my records, Phil World, Phil Comes Alive, Suburban Legends, all of which we'll probably revisit at some point as things come up. On P2's iPod. Talk about my recordings. What are some of the other classic recordings we've done, Kurt? We've done Every Picture Tells a Story, Rod Stewart.
We've done Southern Accents by Tom Petty.
Tom Petty, another Tumbleweed, 80s record.
Tumbleweed Connection, Elton John.
St. Dominic's Preview.
Graham Parsons.
Van Morrison, Graham Parsons Records.
Yes.
Dire Straits' first album.
That's right.
So we've done several, but mostly kind of older, classic,
we've
mostly
been in the 70s.
We've been in the 70s.
It's a great decade.
Well, Kurt is over there on the wall, rifling through my vinyl records, eagerly looking for some inspiration, seeking something that catches his fancy. Synchronicity by The Police. I was a little surprised to see you pull this out, and just, you know, wow, oh my gosh, where did it come from?
Well, this album came out in 1983. At that time, I was 7-8 years old. Mm-hmm. That was right around the time that my rock and roll consciousness was coming into its own. I was old enough to be aware. And in my house, my brother and I, We were buying records at an early age.
Music guys.
Yeah, I mean, my brother.
You and your brother, Kent. Kent South, great mandolin
musician,
player.
Great musician as well. Out of College Station.
Right.
He and I were, I mean, he was buying Dylan records when he was 9, you know. I mean, we were talking about great rock and roll albums at a very young age. So this was at the height of MTV. You know, MTV was the cultural icon. It was driving everything that we
still
listened
on the
to.
Rise, not near its peak.
Yeah, it hadn't peaked. It was a new thing.
It was a new thing. 83.
This video I remember the video for King of Pain is one of the ones that I really remember. So
that's with the candles. That's wrapped around your finger.
That's wrapped around your finger.
Yeah. That's a great video, though, before he's dancing.
Yeah.
I have only come here seeking knowledge.
But the Police and Synchronicity was just a huge, ubiquitous album at the time.
Oh, dude. Everyone had those T-shirts, you know, with the yellow, blue, and red stripes. And it was their fifth record.
It was.
Of course, you had
the final record.
Fifth and final album. I can't remember if when the record came out, they'd already talked about giving up, you know, quitting. I can't remember.
Was it during the tour?
Have you seen the tour footage where Sting's got the big feather pads and he's on the mini trampoline with the white bass just jumping up and down, spiky yellow hair.
He's playing like a Steinberg bass or something.
Yeah, Stuart Copeland's on the drums. He's got like, you know, court casual shorts on.
Yes.
No shirt, big headphones, and he would wrap his hands in metal.
The metallic tape.
Metallic tape.
Yeah.
Like masking tape, duct tape, you know.
And you had a...
Keep the blisters off.
They epitomized the 80s with this album in a lot of ways as far as their fashion. And, you know, for those of you who don't remember MTV, especially when you were young and impressionable like I was, really branded a lot of this stuff in your head. And this stuff sticks with me almost 30 years later.
Of course, the Police were the beneficiaries of having a great-looking band. They all had they kind of quit dyeing their hair, but early on, you know, Outlandos de Amor, their first record, and Regatta de Blanc, their manager Miles Copeland, Stewart's brother, who is the manager of the Police,
right,
and is still Sting's manager to this day.
Yeah.
They'd all dyed their hair. Andy Summers and Copeland dyed. Sting already had blonde hair. But they all had the blonde hair, and they had kind of a shtick. But you know that Outlandos record they were doing, So Lonely, and Roxanne was on the first album.
Yeah.
But they were still kind of a punk band, a British
They were
late
kind of a
70s,
post-punk.
They were new wave kind of deal.
Yeah, they kind of bridged the gap between punk, new wave, and what turned into 80s rock. Really.
But what they benefited was, they started, you know, in the 70s, you just didn't have MTV. So they benefited, you know, when that rocket ship went up. What was it, 80, 81, whatever it was. The Police, man, you had this talented and attractive, marketable, great-looking band that would benefit from being on MTV 24 hours a day.
I mean,
the old hippie guys who were, you know, they said, man, it mattered more what you looked like and not what you sounded like.
Right.
The Police were that rare combination that, they were a bunch of attractive guys, but all great musicians.
Yeah.
And, God, just huge hit songs. I mean, just to this day that are just, you know, Every Breath You Take. I mean, it's a ridiculous a selection of hits on that record.
What's interesting on this album is that side two is the side that has all the hits on it. It starts off with Every Breath You Take, which, of course, is one of the biggest singles of the 80s. And still to this
Michael
day...
Michael Stipe, singer
song.
For R.E.M.,
yes.
said it was the greatest love song he'd ever heard or the greatest obsession song he's ever heard.
Yeah.
It's so simple, you know?
Yeah, four chords, the whole song never changes. You know, very simple song. King of Pain is the next one, Wrapped Around Your Finger. Those are the three huge singles off of this album that all happen on side two. But, you know, for a young kid, especially growing up in the very conservative, anti-rock and roll house that I did, seeing the Police just... and all their weirdness and all their glory. Seeing these weird videos, hearing these strange songs.
And they did have that weird, like, kind of apocalyptic video.
Very.
Synchronicity, too.
Yeah.
suburban family morning. I love that song.
That is
and
such
that
a
video,
good song.
They had kind of the wind and Sting. This is kind of when he was getting ready to be in that movie Dune. Remember that? That was,
yeah,
that was around the same
right.
time.
Almost kind of space age in a way.
Mad Max era.
Yeah.
A lot of that going on.
Yeah.
You know, apocalyptic nuclear deal. You know.
But
at the bottom of a dark Spanish rock. Sting, dude.
Oh, man. And I just, when I was rifling through the records over there, I saw this one, and it immediately took me back to that time when I was really discovering rock and roll and getting into it and starting to buy my own albums. I remember I bought this on cassette.
You know, Sting, I can't remember where I stumbled across. I mean, of course, I was a little older than you were at that time.
You were 28 when this album came out.
I was 28 when the Synchronicity came out. Now, I might have been like maybe, 8, 9 or 10 maybe. And, you know, kids, older brothers had that record and those t-shirts and those. And I was like, God, who are those guys? You know, but I already knew the Police. You know, I was kind of getting into rock and roll and stuff like that. They were just a cool band, a band that you couldn't help but love.
Kind of reggae influenced.
Oh, well, early on, really super reggae influenced. You know, I mean, that whole late 70s, the Clash was, you know, big reggae.
Yeah.
Kind of deal. Britain was really had a reggae thing going on.
Yeah.
And in the punk world.
Sure.
And, ska kind of deal. That's really where all that really started. Synchronicity, man, was just the culmination of all these guys hitting their peak, their collective peak.
Yeah,
man.
It was.
Sting was the master at having the most depressing lyrics, but then producing them and singing them with this sunny type melody.
Right.
Listen to the lyrics of King of Pain. It's horribly depressing. But it's just, I stood here before. But it's just a masterful song. You take a real happy melody with really depressing
lyrics.
But
you could still put that song on at a party and not bring it down.
Yeah.
People's, this is a great song.
And you got another, I love the image of there's a skeleton choking on a crust of bread. I mean, what the hell does that mean? I love it.
What is that?
The other great part about it that really hits me sometimes is many times you hear Every Breath You Take is at the end of after the bridge where it's, you know, I keep calling baby, baby, please. And there's just that single piano chord that's just dang. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
As the chord progression goes, it just stayed right there. Ding. Dang, just never moves. And, man, you find yourself just listening to that chord being struck, you know.
Mesmerized.
Over and over. It's, well, can't you see? Before it goes into that. I love that little just piano thing. They had very simple arrangements, really.
Yeah, very simple.
A lot of busy drumming.
Just a three-piece band.
Three-piece
guitar,
band,
bass, and drums.
A lot of busy drumming. You know, Sting's a bass player. I never was really... He's not a mule on those records.
No.
You don't really notice a lot of just...
Well, and the bass is kind of buried in the mix on some of their songs, too. That you, but I mean, for the most part, Sting is,
you know,
just...
But, I mean, listen, like Solo McCartney or the Beatles, the bass is just
all
loping
over the place.
Along.
Yes.
You know? Rush. He's, you know, you have like bass stuff. Sting's known as a bass guy, but he's not an over-the-top bass
player.
He hits
the root note and stays with the kick.
That's
about it. Which
that's
is... You know, it's
sings
great.
And jumps on a trampoline.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah. I also love Miss Grudenko. It's a kind of a deep cut off of that.
Very.
Is anybody alive in here? Is anybody alone in here? Nobody but us. Nobody but us. Read them off. Where's some of the other
ones? It starts off with Synchronicity 1.
That's a gank, 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 gank.
God, that might be my favorite cut on the whole album.
It just kicks it off.
Walking in Your Footsteps.
Great song.
Another great one. Oh, my God. Mother.
Kind of crazy. Mother, very... A wild mother, and mother's sort of the what was that Tom Petty song nobody liked? They're off of Spike.
Oh, Spike, yeah.
Hey, mother's Spike, sort of the Spike of
it
that
is
record.
The Spike of this record. Miss Grudenko, which you just
there
mentioned,
you go,
Synchronicity 2, another big hit.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then side 2, Every Breath You Take, King of Pain, Wrapped Around Your Finger, Tea in the Sahara.
Tea in the Sahara, yeah.
So
now that doesn't have Murder by Numbers on it.
No,
but it was on. like the CD version.
Yes, it was.
Yeah,
it was.
Was it taken off? I remember seeing it was taken off.
Well, on the CD version, there was 12 or 13 songs. Numbers.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah,
it's as easy to learn as your ABCs.
What? Great song. What was song. The story behind that? Why?
Controversial. Remember someone? Yeah. Was it like someone in the Reagan administration was upset? I was telling people to go kill people or something.
Yeah, know, it was a controversial song. Yeah, definitely.
Murder by Numbers, but it was a really cool. Great song, man.
Very good
chorus
song.
Guitar.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah,
But you know, I was when I look at an album like this, or you know, Southern Accents by Tom Petty, or anything out of the early '80s, when that was, you know, the pop music of the day, very much part of the MTV era. A lot of this is the stuff that first just really turned me on to rock and roll.
Yeah.
And introduced it to me, and so. When people are often shocked when they ask me, as kind of a viewed as a country guy in Texas, like what really influenced you? Synchronicity influenced me as much or more than any country album.
Yeah,
because it was the first thing that I heard. I didn't grow up in a house where my dad was spinning Ray Price records all day.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But this, you know, this album and a lot of the rock of the MTV era is what was my first exposure, and that led me into the older stuff. I discovered that, and then I started backtracking and found Dylan and the Grateful Dead and all that other stuff, you know. And you know, they weren't going to show Jerry Garcia on MTV,
with his
you know, eating a Coney and shooting heroin and weighing 380 pounds,
bitching about Nam.
Yeah, but
while back.
But you know, Sting and the guys, they were a great pop band of the day. And to this day, you know, you put this album on, there's some production. There's some production that you can tell, hey, this wasn't cut in 74, but it still sounds
great.
It's
pretty crisp, man. It's not effects-y, really.
Well, this was probably right when they first started using digital recording, maybe?
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, it was around that Brothers in Arms, Dire Straits, we were talking about the first one.
Yeah,
of course,
maybe
Sting
this was
sang
right
on.
Yeah, that's right. That Sting era, did sing on it.
But, just connecting the dots on all these early
guys,
man.
Especially those British guys, man. It was all
I remember the, after this record, the Police tour, a big tour, they played the big show. I can't remember where it was. With U2, where famously the Police invited U2 on the stage at the end of their show. It was kind of their last show together.
That was at Wembley, wasn't it?
And they all ceremoniously took off their guitars and handed it to U2.
Yep.
And walked off the stage as if to say, like, hey, you know, we've been the biggest band in the world, but here you carry the cross. This is it, you know. And they just kind of handed them all their instruments and walked off the stage. Mm-hmm. And that's how the Police chapter ended, really.
So where did Bono get the big flag from? Did Sting hand that to him?
No, I think that was done before. Yeah, under Blood Red Sky. Well, that's Synchronicity, man. A great record. The Police. Had mixed feelings with the reunion tour. I didn't have any interest in going.
It was the largest grossing tour of the year, though.
Is that right?
Yes,
oh, yeah,
it was.
I know everybody wins.
It was huge.
And I know it was great. I've seen Sting solo several times.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's a big Sting fan, so am I. We saw a great show in Austin, man, at the old South Park Meadows. Just an awesome show. Like Mercury Falling.
Yeah.
He's fantastic, man. I'm just a... People, Sting's one of those guys people give me a really hard time for being a huge fan of, but I was a huge Police fan and was a huge fan of his, Nothing Like the Sun, Dream of the Blue Turtles.
Nothing Like the Sun was that was.
I think his greatest solo record is 10 Summoner's Tales.
Yeah.
Is really phenomenally great. I still listen to it a lot. You know, Fields of Gold, If I Ever Lose My Faith in You. And there's a lot of, the whole album, like deep into the record, there's stuff. Really great stuff from Sting. I've lost track with him over the years, kind of since that record.
Well,
Mercury Falling era, I was still with him.
He's been levitating a lot lately.
Been levitating. He did a whole record by like a some unknown minstrel that was discarded in a ditch outside of Milan back in the 1500s or something. Or something crazy like that.
He's big in the medieval warrior stuff.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's always recording in a castle, sipping from a goblet.
Yeah.
There was one scene from some documentary about Sting where he's sitting in his house in Tuscany or somewhere. He says, it's great. I'll wake up in the morning and pick up my guitar and play a bit of Bach and look at the sunrise. And I was like, oh, jeez. But sometimes it's a little over the top. Like, is that really what he
does
in the
morning? Whereas Ron Wood is waking up in the gutter outside of a pub in London and just pulls another flask of scotch out of his coat pocket and goes over to Keith's house and they pull out Telecasters and play Blind Lemon Jefferson all night.
That's right.
That's the difference between the British.
It's a different
rockers.
way to go. Well, that is The Police, man.
Good album.
Something tells me we'll do some other Police records.
Yeah,
man,
we need to.
In the vault from time to time.
Orlando No More needs to come up because that was their first.
That'll come up.
That needs to come up.
I was also a big fan of Ghost in the Machine. Was always a big
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
I think that was their third record. Fourth record.
That was their fourth. One. That was done in 81.
Yeah, right before this one. Then you had Zenyatta Mandata, third one, and Regatta de Blanc, and Orlando's de Amor. A wordful, kind of a... Kind of a mouthful of those
Police album titles.
Well, there you have it, folks. Thanks for listening. Man, what a great episode. Thanks for being here, Kurt.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's
really
good to be
enjoyed
here.
Talking touring and gear and the mailbag. We will see you again next week. Tune in. Write us at phil@philpritchard.com. You can get all of my music at p2tunes.com or iTunes. Call me about coming to record at the studio. Trinidad World Recording. It's 817-733-5256 for all your questions. Go to phil@philpritchett.com for email, www.philpritchett.com. Stay in touch with us. Subscribe to the podcast. Tell people, only people you like now, to get on the inside, get in the know, sign up for the podcast, and find out what's going on. Thanks, Kurt. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.